Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for December 23rd, 2018. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Joining me as always, welcome Catherine Smith.
Greetings from Atlanta.
And welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
All right, good to have y'all on, I guess, this Christmas Eve. If we're ever on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day, we have problems. But Christmas Eve seems to be okay for us. So even getting a guest, got a great one tonight, Lachlan McIntosh from South Carolina, and the Palmetto State is always active, and they got several stories in the news, and we're going to talk to Lachlan about those about 30 minutes into the show. But until then, that one little city that we call our nation's capital does not slow down, even when it shuts down. But before we get to the shutdown, to me, in a lot of ways, a bigger and possibly much more scary long-term story was the Secretary of Defense, James Mattis, resigned. And it's not just that he resigned and you know, he has a military background and is more qualified than many people in the Trump administration. It was the manner and the reasons in which he resigned, to me, that are far more troublesome. Tim, kind of what were your thoughts on the way this happened, you know, pretty abruptly?
Yeah, it did. I think that Mattis, for a long, long, long time, figured that he could do some good by staying there and keeping Trump from doing something just totally off the wall. I think that probably worked when him and Kelly and earlier Tillerson kind of had the situation bracketed in. Is that a good way to put it? They had this agreement between all of them that, you know, one of us will always be in Washington. We'll make sure we keep our eye on things so that he just don't issue some crazy executive order, go off the reservation or something like that. Finally, what Trump did with Syria was the last straw. You know the deal with the Kurds over there, and Mattis just, you know, he, with his military bearing, he said, you know, you don't desert a friend on the field of battle like that abruptly. And he, you know, you saw the resignation letter, and he just pretty much told Trump, maybe it's time you found somebody that agrees with you on this stuff. So that's too bad. The last adult in the room, someone put it, has left. And of course, you know, Brett McGurk, who was a liaison on ISIS, he also resigned in protest. So this is more chaos to pile on, more kindling for the fire. This is pretty serious, and it caught his own party by total surprise too. And there's just a lot of unhappy people in Washington right now.
Yeah, and we'll get to some more of the stuff, but let's continue to cover this properly. Catherine, you know, James Mattis, we've heard that he really puts the military people first more so than, you know, the government officials. And Lepel said he stayed on because of the people under him, not the person above him, because he's kind of had some reservations for a while. But he didn't mince words in that resignation letter, did he?
No, he did not. And I think the obviously the growing concern is that now there's no one available to advise him. I mean, to advise the president. At least before that, he had these three experienced diplomats. Or, you know, or actually experienced military people, not three, but two. But now there's no one there. He may not have their guidance, but at least they were there if he needed them. But now there's no one. And he clearly, the president clearly doesn't have the vision or foresight or experience to make good judgments about our military placement around the world. So it's a growing concern. And I get, you know, people are saying on the talk shows this morning, they're saying, well, the president deserves to have someone whose views align with his. Okay. But who is that? Who are those people? There aren't very many people that have any experience that align with his views, because he's wrong about so much. So it's scary, actually, to me. So what do you think, David?
Well, and you know, he deserves to have somebody that aligns with his views until you find out that he really – does he have any views? Or will he listen to people at all? I mean, I got the idea that, you know, President Obama was not by no means a military expert. And while he might not have gone in saying, yes, I'm going to be the most hawkish person in the world, I think he did with his worldview still listen to the military advisors. And there's probably a lot of presidents of both parties that have done this. And if, you know, Donald Trump said, you know, I really don't know a lot about military matters, but I'm going to have a view of, yes, America is going to be strong and tough, but I'm going to listen to my advisors, that's at least a – you know, a rationale. And I think that's missing. I mean, Tim, why is Donald Trump wanting to pull the forces out of these two places so abruptly? I mean, you make it say, hey, we've been in some of these places for so long, let's come up with some type of drawdown strategy over time. And we've had some of those over the time as well. But, okay, we want a further drawdown strategy. But this seems pretty abrupt. In some places, this is going to be half the troops you know, about as quickly as you can pack. I mean, what's Trump's theory here?
Well, I don't know if it's as much a theory as it's a practice. He does things abruptly. I mean, look at some of the other news going on, and you can see that he pretty much does things on the fly. He'd been wanting to do this for a long time, and basically was talked out of it by General Mattis. But this time he did it and didn't even consult General Mattis or apparently anyone else at the Pentagon. Donald Trump wants people around him who are totally loyal to him and who do not question his directives. He does not want to be presented with alternatives. He wants what he wants, and he wants it now, and he thinks that's fine, so let's do it. I don't know who convinced him, by the way, that the war against ISIS was over and that they were defeated. Who convinced him of that? I haven't been able to put my finger on that one. I don't know where he would have even gotten such a thing unless he just thought it up and said, okay, we've won, let's you know, I don't know. I don't know what to tell you.
I think
I read today that ISIS claiming victory, Catherine.
I think a lot of it is just he's trying to distract everyone from the wall. You know, he doesn't want to talk about the wall, so he'll just do other things to distract attention.
He does have a habit of trying to change the news cycle by doing something spectacular during that same news cycle. Well, I tell you what, when, you know, they're in the middle of talking about a government shutdown, which, you know, was another sudden move of his. The coverage is not going that well. The news cycle is not going that well. The stock market is just in a free fall. Buddy, he certainly changed the narrative there with this resignation, didn't he?
Well, he didn't do it as well as he has in the past. I mean, it is still a big talking point, the shutdown and, you know, the other items. So he wasn't as successful as he's been in the past.
Well, and I think now he's getting criticized by both sides on a lot of these different issues. So, therefore, did he distract a little bit? Yes, but he actually made another. It's like he had a dumpster fire and he just caught another one on fire. Well, which one do we look at? Which one do we put out first? They're both dumpster fires. I mean, it's just – it's really no plan. I mean, he's got the stock market that may go more into free fall. We're reading Mnuchin's trying to – beg everybody not to sell off. You got the government shutdown. You got his new chief of staff that, you know, criticized so many things about him, his moral character, his wall idea, everything else. And you've got him putting the American military in some peril in certain theaters. And so all of it's bad. I mean, at least if you weren't good at everything, you could find something you're good at and execute it well. Instead, he's got a four-ring circus. And the elephants are crapping everywhere.
You know, he perhaps has been feeling since the midterm election results especially became apparent that the walls are beginning to close in on him a little bit. And this is just how he reacts by lashing out inch and imaginable. And none of it making any sense. Donald Trump has not had to face the type of intense pressure and the growing amount of problems that he is now facing as president. Other presidents are prepared for this sort of thing, both by temperament and training. This president is not. Maybe he's just losing it a little bit, guys, because he doesn't really seem to have a handle on things, even for Donald Trump right now, does he? I mean, he doesn't seem to have a handle on anything.
Yeah, there's a lot of balls
in there.
Like this morning on this week, Mulvaney was on, and usually when the chief of staff or any like cabinet or cabinet level, that kind of person is on, they usually focus on one thing, right? They'll say like, well, this week, we have the government shutdown, so they talk about that. Well, this morning it was like a whole laundry list. He's like, he started to say something,
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't Stephanopoulos this morning, whoever it was, said, oh, well, we're going to get to that in a minute, but let's finish this. I mean, they must have gone through like five different really important, topics. So, I mean, he's got to feel. Like you said, he's got to feel the climbing. And we know that he is not very poised and when it comes to being under pressure.
Yep.
He's not the guy to go to when there's pressure.
Well, David, is this a good angle that Catherine and I are coming up with here that he has just never faced this type of intense pressure, and he just frankly is failing on all fronts to handle it. So the only way he knows how to handle it is just to lash out almost incoherently.
Yeah, I mean, because he has, like you said, no governmental training, and then he doesn't want to surround himself with people that know about government. And so he's just handicapping himself by not listening to any kind of advisors.
He's lost them all.
Yeah. Yeah, he runs them off with his personality. Do y'all remember Bob Kerry?
Yeah.
When he ran for president, he talked a lot about health care, and they called him Johnny One Note. Well, right now we've got Donnie No Note because he doesn't have anything that he's competent at. I mean, because you can't – you know, come up with, you know, sleight of hand realist deals as a way to run the government. I mean, so therefore his big skill, the big real estate deal, flipping some property, is just not a skill in government.
You know.
And so he's left with nothing.
I'm sitting here laughing, and what you said was amusing, but at the same time, I'm really, really, really worried. Now, look at this administration. Who can, you know, just political people like us point to and say, okay, if worse comes to worse, this guy or this lady right here, they got this. Who can we? I can't think of anybody suddenly in his inner circle that we can point to and say with assurance that this person could handle the worst thing that comes down the pike. They're all gone. It's scary.
Yeah, I mean, well, you kind of wonder if, are we going to hear that the next Secretary of Defense is going to be somebody off of Fox and Friends? I mean, that's
right.
Who he's tapping, people that he sees on TV. I don't know who he sees on TV with a military background, because hopefully he didn't watch G.I. Joe cartoons. Catherine?
Yeah, well, I've said for a long time, you know, probably my whole life, since I've thought about politics, that one of the key most important things about a political leader, a president or a mayor or a governor or even senators and congresspeople and local leaders is that they are able to select good advisors to surround them that come from all different places, whether they're from the military or corporate or higher education or wherever they, the nonprofit world, so that they can get a good perspective on all the issues. Well, and I think we've seen presidents in our past that have done exactly that. I think going back to Nixon and Johnson and Carter, all through Clinton, even the Bushes, I think, you know, they surrounded themselves with smart people who could advise them. But this president, I mean, there's nobody, I mean, who's going to do it? Like, not only is there no one there, but who's going to sign up for it? I mean, look at how hard it was for him to find a chief of staff, which is not really a, you know, political job. I mean, it's not really it is an advisory job, but of all trades to be a chief of staff. But I don't know. I just feel like
he really didn't find a chief of staff. He just moved someone from another position and said, okay, until I find a chief of staff, you're the acting chief of staff. He went down the list of people. Nobody wants the job. Certainly none of the people that you were just talking about, Catherine, the A-list people that we've been used to, say, I don't know, a Dr. Rice that Bush Jr. had. I couldn't stomach Dick Cheney, but he knew how government operates. The A-listers do not want to sign up for the jobs now, and I just don't know where he's going to find quality people, or even at this point, if he wants to find quality people. I know I've said 100 times I ain't never seen nothing like this, and nobody has, but at a certain point, you just run out of adjectives to describe what you're seeing here. Describe it, David.
And I will say, this really, I mean, kind of is a flaw in our federal government, because if this were a state, there would be a recall election. Or if this were a parliamentary system, there'd be a vote of no confidence at this point. You know, he's going to get his full 4-year term, barring whatever Robert Mueller comes up with. But, I mean, there's no way for America to really self-correct on this. And I'm not saying, because I do think, you know, we had the author of How Democracies Die on a few weeks ago, Stephen Levitsky, and I really believe if you were to put in a recall election or you would put a vote of no confidence in, then in our current political environment, the other party would just be doing it left and right. But Donald Trump is really a special exception because of how underqualified he is. I mean, I still cannot fathom how, with the Republican Party having 16 candidates, they picked very likely the 16th most qualified. I mean, definitely the 14th or 15th most qualified. I mean, they had at least 10 people that were more qualified for this job, and somehow they went with this individual. So really, I think the party primary system needs to get looked at, how somebody can escape through and take out people that are sitting senators and sitting, you know, former governors of large states that are far more competent people in any field. Let's move on to Mick Mulvaney. He's the chief of staff, but then Donald Trump has already soured on him because of those comments that came out about how he didn't think the wall was a real solution. It was juvenile. He also said he was a, you know, low moral character. Catherine, is this relationship over before it starts?
Well, he actually responded to that today on this week. They played that clip where he said that, what did he say? What did he say? It was low moral character or something like that. And he said,
yeah.
Well, you know, I didn't really, that was before the primary was over and I was supporting another candidate. And now, you know, I've worked with him for 2 years and we've worked closely together and he understands what was happening then. Well, I mean, it was all like amazing spin. The guy obviously had been coached about how to answer it. So, I mean, I think the truth was what he said was his truth, but now he's got to, you know, backpedal because, I mean, why did he take the position? That's my question. Like, he's at OMB. Like, why not stay there?
I rather think he was told to take the position if the truth be known, but, you know, we don't know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, probably what he did is he took the cabinet out to eat at some establishment that has the little light-up coasters, and they passed it around, and whenever their table was called, whoever was holding the coaster got the job, and that was Mick Mulvaney. That might be my theory. Well, let's talk about you come in as chief of staff, and instantly you deal with a government shutdown. And we've had these before, but typically during the government shutdown, they don't hit during Christmas time. And therefore, people are at least in Washington playing parts on C-SPAN, looking like they're working for the American people to renegotiate to give the government open. Everybody's gone home for Christmas. A lot of these people have finished their terms, and the new Congress
right.
is going to get reinstated early in January. And so this is really probably the messiest-looking government shutdown, even more so than the one in 1994. Tim, what is this mess?
Well, you know, the mess is everybody thought they had a deal, and they did. Senators, or most of them, had already gone home. They had passed out a clean bill on a continuing resolution unanimously, and funding the government until February. They've done this. How many times have we seen in recent years is pretty much how the government has financially run, and the president apparently signed on to it. But, you know, we hear that the president started looking at listening to radio hosts like Limbaugh and Laura Ingraham and Fox News and Coulter, these people who were among his most ardent supporters were suddenly calling him everything under the name of the sun, including a traitor and a coward and backing down and this and that and the other, and how his presidency was over and how his base would abandon him. And next thing we know, we have Paul Ryan summoned to the White House the morning of the House vote. They have a caucus, and they add the $5 billion in spending for the wall, And, of course, it has no chance of passage in the Senate. They couldn't even get 50 votes to vote to vote. They got 47 votes and 47 against, with Pence casting a tie-breaking vote. And then, of course, you got to have 60 votes to overcome a filibuster. That was never going to happen. Mitch McConnell made a speech, sent everybody home until Thursday. And there we are. This may be a lengthy shutdown unless reality just rears its ugly head on Trump. Isn't it funny how he was going to take all the blame, said so, on television in front of the cameras, and now all of a sudden it's the Democrats' fault. It's a mess.
Go ahead, Catherine.
You know, the thing about this is, David, you're a teacher. Tim, you're retired, but you used to work, and I work. Can you imagine? I mean, the very least that Congress is supposed to do is provide a budget. Like, that's the bottom, right? They aren't doing anything else, right? There's not any bills really of any significance happening, and they can't even, and now they can't even get the budget. So you've got the president and Congress not doing their job. I mean, if I had performed that badly in my job, I would get fired. David, if you didn't like go in and teach every day, you just like went in and sat at your desk and didn't do anything, or Tim, when you were working, you just went into the office and just sat at your desk and played computer games, we'd all get fired. But these guys, they are not doing their job, and it's just kind of baffling. And now all these, hundreds of thousands of, hundreds of thousands of government workers are going to suffer because of it, as well as the people who rely on the services that are provided. Now, I know a lot of the government is already funded, so it's the budget is, like my friend who works for the CDC, he's not going to be furloughed or anything. But I just think when you look at the bigger picture, it's like shocking that these people can get away with not doing their jobs.
Well, and they agree on a lot of stuff. And actually, I think the congressional members and the senators, enough of them agree. Donald Trump realizes that this is the absolute last shot at his wall. Because once Democrats take control of the House, the wall is done. It's probably already done. But, I mean, I guess he thinks this is his last chance to, take a stand. And, of course, Ann Coulter left him on Twitter, and that was really the big wake-up call.
That is
somebody
the
said,
problem.
Think how scary that is. He listens to Ann Coulter and Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity more than he listens to James Mattis. Tim?
The problem is, they had a deal, and he just all of a sudden changed course on the whole Congress without so much as a how do you do. You just can't do things like that. If you got a deal, you got a deal. If he didn't want a deal to start with, he should have said so when he had the cameras in the Oval Office there with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. Good grief. Oh.
Well, Catherine, how that so badly for him?
You're dropping out, David.
Well, it's doing pretty
we
good for a while.
Him.
Catherine, do you think that's part of the problem? Is the fact that Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer made him look bad, and that's part of the reason he ripped up the deal?
I think that might be part of it, but I think you and Tim hit it on the head when you said that he would. I think it was more the public, or not public, but the, Twitter outcry, the Ann Coulters, the Rush Limbaughs, the Sean Hannitys. I think those are the voices that he's more concerned about. He thinks that they represent his base. And I think that's the people he's worried about. I mean, let's face it. He doesn't think of himself as president of the United States. He's president of his supporters.
And that's pretty scary for any president to feel that way. But he's a president with a base of 35-37% of the American people when you look at his true base. Tim, what's going on with the space strategy?
Well, I don't know. You know, he's got it in his head that the base was enough before. It's not going to be enough this time because some people voted for him and not his base. He also needs to look at the battle he's fighting. 59% of the American people oppose that border wall. It's not a popular move to make.
And so do the experts who are on the ground there. They don't want it.
Yeah.
They say, and everybody's telling him, well, but he's not listening, that, you know, this isn't going to solve a lot of the problems. A lot of things, a lot of drugs and people come in by other means than across the border, across the, you know, ground border. And they come in through the major border, you know, through border channels. You know, the number of people who actually, you know, cross the border illegally and, you know, like in the middle of the night across a border that this wall would block is minimal compared to the ones that come through, you know, legitimate border security. So
that's true.
Yeah,
and the tunnels,
you know,
and the flights,
right,
and there's all kinds of ways.
David, you're still going
in
and out on us.
I'm sorry, and trying to text as it is. Well, I think I'm a little better right now. Let's move on to another topic real quick, and then if we can get our guest on the phone here in a second, we'll switch gears real quickly. But this past week in the Atlanta Constitution, it was announced that Georgia would move from electronic voting back to paper ballots. Now, they hadn't chosen what kind or anything else. We know when Georgia moved to electronic ballots in response to Florida in 2000, it was one of the first states to go to electronic voting. And, you know, the machines, I'm sure, were – I forgot which year they actually went into effect. It was 2002, 2004. But they are now well over a decade old and having issues, and then there's security problems. Catherine, kind of what's your thoughts on this switch back, if you will?
Well, I'm not sure that we would call it a switch back. I think it's going to be sort of a combination. It sounds like the most logical solution is going to be sort of a combination. It's going to be an electronic I mean, one of the solutions they're offering is an electronic device that you make your selections on, and then it prints out a ballot for you to approve, and then I guess you sign it or something, and you give it back to the poll workers, so that there's a way to track the votes if the machines, you know, break down or whatever. That seems like the and I think that's a good solution. I've never been really happy with the electronic machines because it's there's no way to check it, right? There's no way to when they talk about recounts, it's like, well, what are they going to recount? They're just recounting the same thing that they already counted. There's no, you know, in accounting, we always have two ways of, you know, you add things up from this selection of data, and then you also have another selection of data, and you add that up, and when they match, then you have then you know that you're, you know, on the mark. But we don't really have that right now. There's no way to double check it. So I think that's good. The one thing I'm a little concerned about is how long it's going to take. Like, it seems like it might slow things down, polling locations, but hopefully they have something in mind for that.
And we'll flesh it out more in a little bit, but right now our guest is called in.
Oh, great.
And so we want to welcome back to the Kudzu Vine. No problem, Catherine. Lachlan McIntosh. Welcome, Lachlan.
Hey, how are you guys doing? Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you. Yes, well, Lachlan, there's just so many issues to talk about, and you've told me this isn't the most important one, so I'm going to be nice to Catherine and Tim and let them ask about this if they want to and other things. But I'm going to start off with the presidential primary in 2020. There was a rumor that came out this past week that the GOP may not have a presidential primary. Donald Trump has no opponents at this point anyway, but it seems like it may be a little bit premature just to shut down the concept of a presidential primary to a president that has a approval rating that has been pretty much underwater his entire presidency, unless you believe Rasmussen reports.
And even then, he's only break even. Well, I think what you're pointing out to is the South Carolina Republican Party. And, and the first thing they said is, hey, this is kind of the way we do things in South Carolina. We're not we are an early state and we have been for a good while now, but we're not Iowa and New Hampshire, New Hampshire rather, they're going to have a primary no matter what. It is kind of tradition that that an incumbent party does not have a primary. Maybe not tradition, that may be a strong word. Let's just say it's happened before. Certainly happened on our side. We didn't have a primary in 2012, for instance. Saves money. The mistake that they're going to make is that if a John Kasich or somebody like that runs a serious race against Trump, or they've already canceled the primary and Trump, resigns or gets indicted or what have you, then they're just going to look terrible. And it further bonds the Republican Party and Donald Trump together forever and ever and ever. And, I know most Republicans are fine with that, but, I still think that that's a real bad mistake and something that, leaders in the party, even at the state level, should be able to understand, but apparently they don't. But in all fairness, this chairman of the Republican Party, I don't really know how to describe him. He has a Twitter account that repeatedly tweets fake quotes from the founding fathers, and the local papers have written several stories about
yay.
It. And they don't care. They don't stop doing it. It's like Thomas Jefferson, liberals shall all burn in hell. Thomas Jefferson, 1780. It's absurd. And they just keep doing it. I mean, they're the craziest of the crazy in the South Carolina Republican Party. And, they lost the South Carolina Republicans lost a congressional race out of it. And I think that's just the first things they're going to lose if they don't shape up and get a little more in the mainstream of even South Carolina. If you're too far right for South Carolina, that's saying something,
Yes. And it seems like there ought to be like a mechanism, say, with the debate, if the time of the debate or however long before, and I know it'd have to be a longer process because it would be a primary election, but the Democrats will be primary in the same day. So you, if there's no
well, we don't,
other
you know, again,
it,
South
no
Carolina's
credible
a little different.
Opponent.
We actually didn't.
Okay, well,
excuse me. We actually
side.
Didn't
yeah.
primary the same day last week, or excuse me, the same day last time. So South Carolina is a little zany,
okay.
as you would expect.
Well, that seems like a money that costs y'all money as a state. If the two parties could at least agree on the same day to hold the primary. It would, you'd open the polls and the poll workers and all those costs. You could then save on cost, which it seems like that's something that both parties would be agreed to, because Republicans could say, hey, lower taxes, and Democrats could say, hey, more spending on social services instead of two elections. Right. So there's something for everybody.
You and your common sense.
but then it does seem like also, I agree, if there's no primary candidate for Donald Trump, well, then you may not hold a primary, but you never know when a Pat Buchanan is going to jump up, like happened in 1992. And if I'm not mistaken, South Carolina was pretty pivotal in Pat Buchanan
uh-huh.
actually gaining some steam. So it seems like
it was actually the other way around. It was the state that kind of did Pat Buchanan in. That was back during the Carroll Campbell days, and South Carolina, I think 92 and 96, South Carolina kind of rose for the establishment. But anyway, that's ancient history now.
Yeah, but I just remember that was the year in which there was a sitting president that had a primary challenger, and that's not
right.
often the case, but that's happened. Well, let me go ahead and pass it to Catherine and Tim with more questions, but I have a feeling they're not going to ask everything up and I'm going to get one more bite of the apple. Catherine?
Hey, Lachlan, nice to have you on. Thank you for taking time so early, so soon before Christmas. I hope we aren't getting taking you away from anything important like wrapping presents.
I'm glad. yeah, I get Amazon to do that for me. good to be here.
I wanted to add, we had a little debate on our, we have a little text group that we text during the week about what's going on, and there was some confusion. I don't know. I was a little confused, I should say. I don't know if everybody else was, about the rules around primary voting in South Carolina. So if I, you may register for a party, but you're not required to, correct?
No, we do not have currently, we do not register by party at all in South Carolina.
Oh, were we talking about North Carolina, you guys? Maybe we were talking about, okay. Well, then that,
no,
that
we
was
were talking
question.
About South Carolina.
Yeah, we were talking about South Carolina.
Okay, so you don't register by party at all, so anybody, yeah. So they're open primaries then?
They're open primaries. The prerequisite is you can only vote in one per cycle. You know, I can vote in the Republican primary and this year, but I can't vote in the Democratic primary this year too. So I can
right,
go vote
okay.
Democratic next cycle, but I think that those are the only rules. And
like,
frankly, if there were a presidential primary, I could vote in the Republican if I wanted to, and then if there were a state primary, you know, a few months later, I could vote in Democratic. So it's pretty wide open here.
Okay. So do you think there's any like there wasn't a Republican primary that some Republicans would move over and vote in the Democratic Party, in the Democratic primary?
Like to try to sabotage? You know, I don't think so. You know, that's always been talk in the past for both sides, but it's never actually happened. I have a hard time seeing most Republicans in South Carolina showing up at a Democratic primary, no matter what. I'm sure if you would do it, but I think that would, I don't think it would be a measurable amount, would be my opinion, based on past history.
Okay, and so we have talked a little bit about the Republican Party in South Carolina. How's the Democratic Party doing?
Just overall or concerning the primary?
Yeah, just in general. Like, are they...
Yeah.
You know, did they do a good job during the primary, during the recent election? Are they, you know,
sure.
ready to go for 2020?
Well, you know, we had a huge win. South Carolina Democrats, probably the biggest win we've had in 20 years. We picked up a congressional district. We picked up the first congressional district of South Carolina. It was the Mark Sanford seat. It's the Charleston seat. It goes from Charleston down to Beaufort. Coastal seat. It's exactly the kind of seat that Democrats were picking up all over the country. It is Republican, or it has been Republican, but it's highly educated, well-to-do, and they are the type of Republicans that do not like Donald Trump. And as y'all may recall, Mark Sanford was defeated in the primary. You know, Mark Sanford, for all his issues, showed some courage to stand up to Trump and got kicked out of his own party by a zealot, a pro-Trump zealot, a candidate who was very strong for offshore drilling. And the Democrats just had a terrific candidate in Joe Cunningham, who will be our congressman here in a couple of weeks. And he ran a terrific campaign. He reached across the aisle. He did it in a, you know, he had Republicans in his commercials, Republican elected officials, mayors especially, talking about how they were going to support Joe because they needed someone to fight offshore drilling. And just ran a terrific campaign and won 51-49. And, you know, like I said, probably the best one South Carolina Democrats have had in 20 years. Now, other than that, we won a state Senate seat up in Columbia, but that was about it. You know, the rest of the state is not going, or the most of the state isn't going very well. We continue to lose ground. I think that what you're seeing here in South Carolina, where we did do well, or the types of places Democrats are doing well everywhere, the cities and the suburbs, like Georgia, like you guys did.
Yeah.
You know, the problem is we don't have in Atlanta. Our cities aren't as big. So there were certainly some bright spots, though. Winning a congressional seat was huge.
Well, that's, you know, it's a marathon. We always say that, right? It's a marathon,
not
a sprint.
Right. You know, and our candidate for governor, James Smith, ran a very lackluster campaign, which I could write a book about how bad it was. But in the end of the day, he got 46%. He got 46% of the vote. 46% of the vote. And, you know, that's to be able to run a pretty bad campaign against an incumbent and get 46% of the vote. You know, that shows that we got to keep fighting. You know, we got to keep going. And because you know, we're down, but I've said this for a long time. South Carolina is a Republican state, but it's not Republican like Idaho. You know, and as things change, as older voters die and more younger voters get into the system, and as our cities grow, which they are in South Carolina, Charleston's one of the fastest growing cities in the country, things are going to change, and we got to be ready for it.
Well, great.
I mean, you guys are seeing that in Atlanta. Think about Georgia. Yeah, absolutely. Think about Georgia. Think about how bleak things looked 4 years ago with Carter and his other races. And then how now
– I mean, we came so close, and we still have questions about the election too. So, okay. Well,
no, I'm not the type of person that says that – oh, sure, you're – I'm sorry. I think we've got a kind of a slow connection. I think that we're not quite on the same – but I was going to say that I don't go around saying people stole elections very much, having worked in electoral politics for 25 years, but they stole that race from us in North Carolina, but they got caught, that congressional race. But I'm pretty sure they stole the race in the governor's race in Georgia, too. I've never seen anything like that.
Yeah, well, I think we all feel that way. I'm going to pass it to Tim for the next question. Thanks so much, Lachlan. That was very informative.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Good evening, Lachlan. Thank you for being on with us tonight again. I wanted to ask you about a couple of your political characters over there in your state. Either of your U.S. senators having very much to say about the shutdown?
You know, I haven't heard either of them say anything, come to think about it.
Huh.
It doesn't mean they haven't. I may have missed it. Obviously, it's the holidays. Graham has been more interested in the pullout in Syria and you know how much he loves war, you know. So he's been vocal about that, but I have not read anything from the shutdown.
Yeah, well, in all fairness, they could be as shell shocked as we are right now about it.
The way
it went down.
Lindsey Graham is really, as you all know, is a really hard person to figure out. There's definitely been Tim Scott is a conservative guy. He's had an interesting life story. I've talked about him a little bit. I think I said one time on the show a while ago that he was the ultimate benefactor of affirmative action, and yet he hates it. But he was literally given seats as a black Republican when he first started in politics, literally handed seats. But there's no question that since he's been in the Senate, I've seen a lot of growth and maturity from him. I think that he is genuinely horrified by Trump on a few matters. I also believe that he's one of the co-sponsors of the federal anti-lynching legislation that I think they're dealing with now. I think he's also, his eyes are starting to open up a little bit as he's been a senator. I think he's formed some friendships with some other senators, other African-American senators. And I've seen a change in him. He's also, on a few occasions recently, spoken out against Trump. So I'm hoping that he'll be more consistent than Lindsey Graham, you know, in his criticisms.
Yeah. Now, another person I want to ask you about, obviously, is Nikki Haley. How was her resignation from the United Nations received there in South Carolina? And do you have any idea, have you heard anything about what she might actually do now? Because she's still very young, politically speaking.
Sure. You know, I think that her resignation, I was taken about like anything else in this administration, just – with disbelief, nobody knows what happened that day. You know, it feels like it's been a year ago, but you know, it was one of those days where, but the first announcement was that she quit or gotten fired. And then the next thing you know, she's at the White House with Trump and she's going to stay on for a few months. I mean, everything's just bizarre. You know, I think bigger picture wise, I think that you know, I think that she did the best she could in that administration. I think she tried her best. She's a decent person. She was an okay governor. She was completely unqualified for the position she was appointed to, but I think that she did the best that she could. You know, look, I think the truth is, with the sad state of the Republican Party in this country, I think that she is definitely somebody who could be seen as a potential candidate for president one day soon. You know, if Trump for some reason doesn't run for re-election, I think you could see her get in. Assuming that he does, I think, you know, she's staying in New York, from what I understand. My guess is she's going to use her contacts and make a little money. I mean, the truth is that she's never been a particularly wealthy person. She probably has the ability to do that now. So my guess is she may see her every now and then on Fox News or what have you, but I think that she'll be concentrating on making a little dough.
But for now, you don't think there's any electoral future for her in your home state?
Not anytime soon. I mean, you know, I imagine Lindsey will run for re-election next year, and our next cycle, Gott's not up, I don't believe. So, I think that she would probably, and like I said, she's not moving back right away. So I think she'll go make money for a couple of years and then probably try to run for president or something soon.
Yeah, and finally, what about Mark Sapper? You know, that was a courageous thing he did in opposing Trump, and it cost him his seat in Congress. Is his political career over?
It might be, but I don't believe that he sees it that way.
My guess is
nobody was pulling for Joe Cunningham to win that race more than Mark Sanford. I would not be surprised at all to see Sanford run for the Republican nomination in 2 years for the first congressional district. Now the question is, can he get it or not? Has the party left him to the point where he couldn't win a primary over there? I just don't know. But Mark Sanford is been in politics now for 20 something years. He's very good at it. That's all he's done. For a guy that's talked about the private sector so much, he hasn't been in the private sector in nearly 30 years. He's been on a government check for a long, long time. I don't see him giving it up without a fight. I definitely think he'll be running again.
All right. Thank you for that, Lachlan. And with that, I will send it back to David. David?
Yes, and I'm going to give him some free advice. If he runs, he shouldn't run in 2020. He should run in 2022, because you're right. He might not win the primary, but if they lose in 2022, Joe Cunningham, then he might could say, well, you need somebody closer to the middle. That's me.
Yeah.
And, of course, if Democrats retake the White House, 2022 will be a much tougher year in more persuadable districts, which I'm sure South Carolina won would be on that list, more so in 2022 under a Democratic president than it might in 2020 with Donald Trump running for re-election.
I agree. I think if Trump's running for re-election.
Yeah. I want to talk about the city. You had mentioned cities, and you said, you know, South Carolina didn't have any one city as large as Atlanta, but we know what happened in Charleston, that congressional seat flipped, but there's two more cities that are of decent size, your state capital, Columbia, and then Greenville, which also Greenville has Clemson right next door, another decent-sized city, Anderson. So there's a metropolitan area there. And then actually Columbia has a college town as well as University of South Carolina. How did those two cities go Democratic-Republican?
Yeah, Columbia is overwhelmingly Democratic now. It always has been a Democratic city, but those margins are also way up. And the county that Charleston, the city of Charleston, is in Charleston County, and Charleston County went, you know, voted 60% in the congressional districts that make up Charleston. Richland County is even more Democratic. The county Columbia is in. That's not a new thing. Unfortunately, the population in Columbia isn't rising as fast as Charleston. Greenville is also heading our way, but the difference there is Greenville has just been so overwhelmingly Republican for so long. We still lose Greenville, but we don't lose Greenville anywhere near the numbers that we used to. And again, the city of Greenville is in Greenville County. The city of Greenville is definitely, it's not 50-50 yet, honestly. So absolutely, we're seeing the same trends in South Carolina that they are around the country, that educated voters, voters that live in cities or near cities, you know, voters that are, that went to college, that are making a little bit of money, they, the people that started the Republican Party in South Carolina, literally, are the people that are now abandoning it fast.
Hmm. Yes, and that's going to be interesting to see, because that's, a diagonal line from north to south across your state. Three largest cities are either going to be Democratic or 50-50. So that's going to, what's the Republican Party then going to do to hold on?
Well, you know, the bleeding hasn't stopped for us yet in the rural areas of the state, the exurbs of the state even. For instance, we're next to Richland County is Lexington County. And Lexington County is a mix of rural and exurb, and that's highly Republican. And Greenville, those small counties in the mountains of South Carolina that you're talking about, that they've gone from being, you know, 50-60% Republican to 70-80% Republican recently. When I started doing politics in South Carolina, you know, the way a Democrat won was kind of a coalition between rural white voters and African American voters. That was your winning coalition, you know. And rural white voters are almost 100% Republican these days, you know. So it's helped us pick up a point or two here this last cycle, the changes. But the changes have a long way to play out before I think we see a lot of benefit to the point where we can really say we're a two-party state in South Carolina again. I think it's going to happen. I just really want to be alive for it when it does, you know.
Incrementalism, a slow process then.
Yeah, but we're definitely seeing a realignment. The realignment is real.
Most definitely. Mm. And across the country, not just in the South, but pretty much every state. Well, Lachlan, before I let you go, where can people follow you on Twitter, read your writings, just anywhere for our listeners to find you?
My Twitter is at Lachlan McIntosh, and LachlanMcIntosh, and that is where you'll see my rage tweets when I get mad at Trump, and some more thoughtful things too. But sometimes I like to throw insults out at the president when I just can't take it anymore.
Yes, and that's where he throws his rage tweets too. So you have that
following
comment.
My leader, my dear leader. Yeah.
Yes. Well, keep up your good work in the Palmetto State. And I have a feeling between the chief of staff and one of the top three Democrats in the House that we didn't even talk about, South Carolina is just going to stay a leader in national politics, even though it's one of 50.
Well, I think so. It is interesting how many South Carolinians have been involved in the Trump administration, but I think you're right, and I think part of it is the early primary candidates on both sides. They rely on these folks that get behind the winners early get rewarded, you know. So I think that's some of it.
Yes. All right. Thanks again, Lachlan.
Okay. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Merry Christmas.
Sir.
Merry Christmas to you guys. Bye.
Yes, Lachlan McIntosh of the Palmetto State. Always good to have him on. Maybe it's something about the weather, the cold weather, but I saw what he was saying about us all kind of talking different times. Well, Tim, we got about a minute. I'm not even going to put my thoughts in, and I'm sure it's going to be a topic down the road. What's your initial thought on the ballot system in Georgia?
Well, did I not hear that there is to be a test of using paper ballots to be conducted in some municipal elections coming up this year? Did I not hear that?
I think
that,
that's right.
Or,
I think that's
yeah.
right.
That makes sense. Yeah.
I think we're going to go there eventually, guys. I think clamoring for it, and actually people in both parties in this state are clamoring for it. I think we're going to see it happen.
Yeah, Brian Kemp had anything to do with it, and we're partisan elections, we'd find out which ones were easier to lose. If it was easier to lose the paper ones and throw them away, that's what Democrats would get. And if it were easier to lose the computer ones, that's what we get. But at least if it's municipal elections, I guess it can be a little more or less partisan, if you will. I have a feeling more news will come out about this, and we can all talk about our experiences with punch cards and optical scan and everything else as we learn more. But I have a feeling since Georgia was one of the leaders going to electronic voting, maybe it's going to be a leader in the next revision, so it'll be something that affects states across the nation. But everybody have a great Christmas. We'll see you on the other side.
Good night.
Good night, guys.
Good night, y'all.
Good night, everybody.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.